I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. It's the Book Show, and on the show, our mission is to spread the word on great reads, fiction and nonfiction. We invite your calls, as always, and in the third segment, I will interview Mark Taylor, who is author of Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. It is a very smart book. My book buddies are here and always excited to tell you about reads they love. We start with our regular contributor, lucky us, Pat Towers, by phone, who I think is one of the best readers and writers about reading in America. Pat, thanks for joining our group. What would you like to recommend?
Well, today I'd like to talk about a wonderful memoir by Abigail Thomas, and it's called What Comes Next and How to Like It. And when I keep telling people about this book, I love it, I keep forgetting the second part of it. I say it's called What Comes Next, and then I pause.
What does that mean?
And How to Like It. It's an extraordinary book. She's says it's a story ostensibly about a 30-year friendship that had a hole blown through it but somehow survived, but it's really about much more than that, and it's very artful. I don't know anybody who writes more honestly than she does. Unparalleled honesty. And it you start reading it and you think you don't quite know what she's telling you about daily things and so on. It seems very casual. And as you go through it, it becomes more and more, I don't want to give away exactly what happens, but there's a great deal of tragedy in the book. But somehow you don't sink into it. She finds a way to write about the hardest things with grace. I mean, she has done two earlier memoirs. One of them was called A Three-Dog Life, which she actually started as a piece in O magazine. But she wrote she has a kind of buoyant lightness, a kind of grace. And I think it has to do with the immediacy. It's like moment by moment she pulls you into something.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. I can't wait to read that.
And she tells you a lot about writing, too.
What is her name again?
Abigail Thomas.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I really think your readers will just find it wonderful.
That's great. So What Comes Next and How to Like It is the title of her memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is a good time to do this follow-up. Roxanne and I both want to talk about the same book.
Right.
We both looked at each other and we held up a copy of the book.
Wonderful.
So but it ties in with you just saying that. This is The Light of the World. It's a memoir by Elizabeth Alexander, the poet at Yale who did was the poet for President Obama's inauguration and has written many, many books of poetry. And so, Roxanne, why don't you take it?
So I want to preface this with this statement. Periodically, I say this is a book that everyone must read. This is the book for this season. And the reason I say that is I always love when poets write prose because it comes, you feel enveloped by, you feel absolutely enveloped by her. And let me say a little bit of what the book is about: the sudden loss of her husband. Elizabeth Alexander is a relatively young woman. Her husband died suddenly. She has two boys, lived here in New Haven at the time. And it's about that. It's about that loss. But it's mostly about love. It's mostly about what a great relationship looks like, feels like, and is kind of texturally. And the thing that really put it in context for me is last week, I read the book like months ago. Last week, I went to a reading that she did at the Yale Art Gallery. And then R.J. Julia was selling books there, so I stood next to her while she signed books. And what I realized is the entire atmosphere in the auditorium, the entire ethos of everyone in the line who knew Elizabeth, either because they read the book or they were a student of hers, had this kind of peace about them and her. And I think it's about Elizabeth, that there's a grand graciousness about her. You know how when you meet people that you're just calmer in their presence, you feel better, you look better, everything better in their being. And that's who I think Elizabeth Alexander is. I had never met her before, but it's what I realized I felt in the book, a kind of generosity of spirit. And she was obviously married that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw her with her boys, you know, that's probably the way she mothers. It's probably the way she teaches, but it's mostly the way she writes.
Yeah. Like a kind of radiance in her generosity.
That's a great word.
Just where she drinks in people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet is so reflective. And I'm so glad that this is
So this book.
So it's about loss, but really love. Yes. Perfectly said.
You will. I would venture a guess that most people that will read this that will just slip into it and stay with it until they finish it.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that great?
It's great.
So happy for her. The Light of the World, a memoir by Elizabeth Alexander. Okay. Here's our phone number, 203-776-WNPR. Rob, welcome to the book show.
Thank you, Faith. I've got a book I want to recommend that I read 23 years ago. It's over 80 years old now, but it feels like it could have been written yesterday. It's science fiction. It deals not only with designer babies, problems of legalized drugs, but also the 30s vision of a 3D TV and movies. It's really good. It's A Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Oh, yes, that's right. There's a classic for you.
Yeah,
that's good to bring
books.
That up, Rob. One of your favorites, Lee, did you say?
Oh, well, yes, of course. It's a classic. It's a really a great
no,
book.
No, did you say it was one of yours, though? One
oh,
of your
sure,
favorites?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I read it when it first came out. It's incredible, but I did. And yes, it's a magnificent book. It's very, I'm very glad that you mentioned it, Rob, because it's the kind of book that really we should always keep in our cultural memory. It's a very important book, The Brave New World. And Aldous Huxley was one of those folks who got really involved in, you say science fiction, it is that, but he got involved in the whole cultural upheaval of the 60s and was instrumental. He was very important.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rob, for that. I really appreciate your contribution. 203-776-WNPR. I'm with Roxanne Cody of RJJ Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut, and Lee Jacobus, who is author of a book of short stories called Hawaiian Tales and writes college textbooks. So, Lee, what do you have?
Well, I've got a lot of things, but I'm going to start with Eric Larson. Eric Larson has written a new book, and it's very important because on May 7th is the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania, just a few days from now, a week from now or so. This is called Dead Wake, and it is the story of the last sailing of the Lusitania. It's an incredible novel. It's not a novel. It's a historical piece of work. And my slip of the lip is interesting because he is called the historian's novelist. Mm-hmm. And you read this as if it were a novel. He talks about some astonishing things that we didn't know about the Lusitania. For example, Winston Churchill thought at this particular time, being important in the naval situation in England, he thought that it might not be a bad thing to have a major passenger ship get sunk, and it would wake America up. And Larson says, for example, that it may have really been a motive for the fact that there were no British warships anywhere near the Lusitania, even though the Germans had announced that they were going to torpedo ships in that area. They had actually put an ad in the New York Times next to the ad for the Lusitania saying it was going to sail. They put an ad right next to it saying it's dangerous. We're going to have we're going to be shooting down or sinking down important ships. Nobody believed it. Everybody went on the boat and they thought, no, this is 1915. Nobody's going to bother us. Europe had been at war for 10 months. And they figured nothing would happen. Larsen does a brilliant thing in focusing on the German U-boat commander who zeroes in on this ship. And you really get a sense of what it was like to be in a U-boat, which was pretty terrible, in fact. Mm. And you get a sense of what this man's motivation was. He knew what he was doing. And you know what the terrible thing was? When Lusitania started to go down, they put out a cry for help. No ships would go anywhere near it because what they had learned was that after one ship had been torpedoed, if naval ships went to get help, then that U-boat would stay there and torpedo those ships. Mm-hmm. So nobody came near the Lusitania for a very long time, and no big ships came near it at all. Mm-hmm. All little ships.
Lee, you're making me realize I know so little about this.
Well, this book will tell you everything you need to know.
Fascinating.
That's what's great about Eric Larsen is you learn about all the books he's written. You learn so much about what you didn't know.
Oh, it's astonishing. It's called Deadwake, and it's Eric Larsen, E-R-I-K.
Deadwake.
Yes, he absolutely makes you feel every moment of this experience. Mm. It's terrific.
Wow. Okay. So we'll go to, on the phone, 203-776-WNPR. We'll go to Lola before we go right back to Pat Towers again. Go ahead, Lola.
Hi. Huge fan of you guys.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you.
RJ Julia, my favorite bookstore ever.
Oh, thank you.
Double nice. Hi.
Roxanne's recommended great books. I just wanted to say that I'm a sixth grade teacher, and I just finished talking about Elizabeth Alexander, her praise song for the day, inaugural poem, with my students because we were discussing westward expansion. And then I get on in my car to listen to you guys. I'm rushing out of school so that I can hear you, and I hear you talk about her new book. So
yeah, see, this is how word spreads about a book.
But I'd like to recommend The Samurai's Garden by Gail Tsukiyama. She's also the author of Women of the Silk and Night of Many Dreams. And I think the way Roxanne described Elizabeth Alexander's presence and the way she writes, Gail Tsukiyama, to me, writes as a poet writes prose. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I've recommended it to many people, and they've all loved it.
Oh, good. The Samurai's Garden. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Lola. Call anytime.
Okay.
All right, we're going to Pat Towers. We're going to take a quick break, though, about 90 seconds or so, and then back with more great reads to recommend, so don't go away. I'm Faith Middleton with my book buddies Lee Jacobus and Roxanne Cody. Thanks to Marion Roy and our producer Jonathan McNichol for work on the show today. I wanted to quickly mention that there is a book called Washing the Dust from Our Hearts. And this is a book that is one half English and one half the language of the people of Afghanistan. And these are poems by the women there. And there's a writing project there. And I was out giving a speech, and someone came up to me and explained this book that this group had coordinated the writing. And these poems are quite amazing, and they explain the lives, the interior lives of and the exterior lives of these women. It's really quite something. And what a project, Washing the Dust from Our Hearts, Poetry and Prose from Writers of the Afghan Women's Writing Project. And this is published in paperback by Grayson Books. And it's translated from the Pari Okay. Pat Towers, what do you have?
Well, it's interesting. We seem to have a feeling for poetry today, because I came across a book by Sharon Olds called Stag's Leap.
Mm.
And that won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2013.
And I
had never read it.
Oh, I love her.
I was looking for a birthday present for a friend, and I picked this up, and I thought, oh, well, this will be good. And I took it home. I started to read it, and I thought, oh, no, this is not a book you can just give somebody. They kind of have to find it.
Yeah.
This book is about her, is really about her husband left her after 30 years for someone else, and she wrote immediately these poems and began writing immediately, but she didn't publish it for 15 years. She's an incredible poet to begin with, but it is the most extraordinary, immediate. The first poem is called "While He Told Me," and it's these moments, and there's so much pain in it, but so much love and so much attention to the sort of sensual moment, and the book is, I simply couldn't put it down. You read it, the arc of it. And you come through all of this. There's a poem about when she told her mother. There's a poem about, I don't know anyone who can write with more immediacy than this.
Isn't that great?
And then she's one of them. She says, "Now I come to look at love in a new way." This is when she gets to, "Now that I know I'm not standing in its light, I want to ask my almost no longer husband what it's like to not love, but he does not want to talk about it. He wants stillness at the end of it. He shows no anger. I show no anger, but in flashes of humor, all is courtesy and horror. And after the first minute when I say, 'Is this about her?' and he says, 'No, it's about you,' we do not speak of her." And the her is seldom spoke of.
But
what is so remarkable about this book to me is that it's this journey through all of this pain and come through out the other side into a kind of transcendence that is really beautiful.
Wow.
And she does it in such a direct style, such an immediate style.
Yeah.
And you do feel the pain. I know I just had finished it, in fact, just a little while ago. And the sense of pain, the sense of anguish, but then working it out, working through it. She needed so much time to do that, but she just worked through it. And you feel it virtually on every page of that book. And physically, it's a very beautiful book, too, just to hold in your hand.
It's one of those extraordinary books that everyone needs to buy it for themselves, I think.
That's a good point.
Pat, what's the name again, the title of the book?
It's A Stag's Leap, and that refers to a wine that she and her husband used to buy.
Yeah.
Stag's Leap, but of course the stag has leapt.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite remarkable.
Oh, I can't wait to see. That's another one now. I have to read that. Wonderful. Thank you, Pat. Let's see. Joe, thank you for calling 203-776-WNPR. Do you have a book to recommend?
Yes, I do. I want to recommend a classic that I think has been forgotten, except in the world of academia. It's called Rastless by Samuel Johnson.
Oh, yes.
And it deals with Prince Rastless, who is an inhabitant of the Happy Valley, where everyone is very well provided for, and everyone's taken care of. They live in tranquility, but he feels as though something is missing. And he embarks on a search for happiness. And it's a very short read, but at one of the high points, which is a very important point in 18th century literature, is the marriage plot, and they get to a very long discussion about, is marriage the best option for happiness for humans? And it's a short book, but it's a very heavy book, and Samuel Johnson is a master of his craft.
Oh, this
is
great. What is that? Are you saying, is it Rastless?
Rastless, R-A-S-S-E-L-A-S.
Yes, Rastless. Okay. Yes, this is a great book. I'm amazed that you recommend it, but I think it's wonderful that you do. It's really an extraordinary book in every way, and it did a lot for his career too. You know, Dr. Johnson is Dictionary Johnson, who wrote our very first comprehensive dictionary. I was talking about Boswell's Life of Johnson a couple of weeks ago here, and I didn't mention that, but I'm glad you did. It's a super book. And very brief, as you point out.
It's very brief, and he wrote it actually in a very short period of time in order to pay for his mother's
That's
funeral.
Right. He got £65 for it, and he had to. He did it for his mother's burial. And
yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Stories by the yard. There you go. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you.
All right. To play off what Joe said, the 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work has come out. And this also links up to everybody else talking about all these divorces. And this is Dr. John Gottman, and he is founder and director of the Gottman Institute, professor of psychology, University of Washington. And this is, I don't know how many copies of this thing have been sold. It's now in paperback. And if you are the type of person who, very smart guy about just how crazy our minds are and how communication among people in such intimate circumstances can go awry. It just has to happen. And so these are all the realms of life that two people can enter and how you get out of the twists and turns of conversation, hurt feelings, things you aren't even aware of, all the things. So if you're someone who, with your partner likes to go through these exercises as a great insurance policy. This is a really pretty smart thing. Daniel Goleman said, "This is eminently practical as a guide to an emotionally intelligent and long-lasting marriage." The 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work. John Gottman. Okay, Roxanne, go ahead.
So before I tell you about this other fantastic book, this show. And the range of books that are being discussed, every show that we've done over 20 years has its own little rhythm. But the rhythm of this show with a recommendation like Brave New World and Samuel Johnson and reminds me about the extraordinary power of reading. I mean, not that we don't all know that, both three of us here or the listening or listening to callers, but it's a very powerful reminder of the range of the ways in which reading. I know that sounds cliched.
No, it doesn't.
But
no.
It's very striking today on the show. It's particularly striking. And apropos of that, the next book I'm going to talk about, I picked up because I read about it in a magazine or a newspaper. And Cheryl Strayed, before she wrote Wild, had written a column on advice on love and life called Dear Sugar. And it was on a website. It was only an online thing. And it was real. People really wrote to her and she really wrote back. So this book that was put together called Tiny Beautiful Things is a... Here's how I would describe it. It's a memoir in the form of giving advice to people. So, for example, one of the first letters is from Johnny, who's having a hard time deciding whether the relationship he's in rises to the level of saying, I love you, or not. And he goes on about his troubles with relationships. So Cheryl writes back to him, his name is Johnny, and says, the last word my mother ever said to me was love. She was so sick and weak and out of her head, she couldn't muster the I or the you. But it didn't matter. That puny word has the power to stand on its own. And the reason I read that paragraph is it's her mother dying, as anybody who's read Wild, had an enormous impact on her. She uses words like puny in a way that she's talking about something serious and then all of a sudden you smile, and she does that a lot. And then she goes on and, she says, I've been thinking about you for weeks, Johnny, trying to think about how I'm going to talk to you about this. And then in other letters, she comes up with a brilliant way of saying, get over it. And talking about you're feeling sorry for yourself. This is, you can't, not feel great about humanity reading this book. First of all, I didn't love Wilde like everybody else did, but I love her now. Reading this book, I love her.
Yeah.
This is a woman with a big, wonderful, funny heart. So it's called Tiny Beautiful Things, Advice on Love and Life from Dear Sugar.
Oh, Pat. Okay. That's great. So, Pat, you like her too?
Oh, I think she's absolutely terrific. Just, again, that zeroing in, that, you know, when that kind of honesty, it's on the page, you get it. And she's so good. I thought she was terrific, and I read some of those. They're absolutely wonderful, and I remember the Johnny one. Yeah.
So, Pat Towers, do you have another book to recommend?
I have a couple of other books, but let's see. Which one to do? In the mode that we're in, I think I'm going to do, since we might not have time for another, I know you've talked about Elena Ferrante, My Brilliant Friend, but I just read it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I was so blown away by it.
Yeah.
I think it's the best book I've read in a very long time. I think it's a classic. I think it's right up with the very, very best things.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing.
Yeah, the mystery of who it is, I don't really care about, because the writer is the writer, whoever it is. And the fact is, it doesn't matter to me who the writer is.
We should explain. Can we just explain for those who don't know this?
It's a pseudonym, I think it's a she. Although some people in Italy have thought it was a man, but I think it's probably a woman. But she's written under this pseudonym. I think this is the first of four books. And I can't wait to read the rest of them. But it's about two girls growing up in Naples after the Second World War who are intensely rivalrous and connected and love each other and get obsessed with each other. But it's the writing. And again, it's this moment-by-moment experience. I mean, and the language, it's translated by Anne Goldstein. I think it's a brilliant translation, but and Jhumpa Lahiri, I was looking things up about it, wrote to her a letter to this whom she doesn't know, how wonderful it is that you're a writer, able to communicate with the world through your words only, your literature only. If I had had the same courage, I would also have liked to pursue my literary career in the same way. To those who consider you an absent writer, I would say anything but. Despite your elusiveness, I detect a door that is more open than closed. And she says, thanks to the mask that makes you invisible, you are able to write and reveal anything. And it's just so interesting because writers get overwhelmed with the attention. When they do become successful, they don't have as much time to write or to speak truthfully or to work.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
It's weird, huh? Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you did that. Thank you, Pat. Let's see. We have Judy on the line. Thanks, Judy. Do you have something to recommend?
Well, you had asked me to call. We had a conversation at the West Hartford Library a couple of weeks ago, and I was
talking
about our book club of 43 years.
Listen to that.
Will you call in and talk about it? So,
I was speaking at the West Hartford Public Library with Amy Bloom, and Judy came up to me and began just casually mentioning that she's been in this book club. And I said, cheerfully, how long have you been in it? Isn't that astounding? Is it 43? 40?
We're in our 43rd year.
Same women?
We started out when we were in our early 30s, and we're all now in our 70s, and it has just been wonderful just to see how we've changed, not only the kinds of books that we read, although I thought we've always read a very high caliber of book. We're very discerning readers, I think.
Yeah.
And we vote on the books that we read at our potluck supper in June each year. We nominate our books, we discuss them, and at the end of the evening, we have 9 books, 9 houses, 9 discussion leaders, 9 dates,
This is like the Iowa caucus.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So what is the book of the moment? What do you...
Well, I am leading, in 3 weeks, I'm going to be leading Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Oh, yes.
She is the, according to my Nigerian author friend, Okene Dibe, who wrote Foreign Gods, she is the leading female Nigerian author today. And it is a wonderful story, very readable, very easy to get into, and I think we're going to have a very good discussion about it. It really is good. It is fiction. We read mostly fiction in our group.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, we will do a nonfiction, but usually we're reading fiction, and we've read many of the authors. We go back to the days when we would sit by the radio, and we would wait for this program to come on, and then we would be writing down names or titles so that we would be able to discuss them at the potluck supper.
Oh.
So you've been a great influence. All of you in sitting there today have been a wonderful influence on our selection of books.
Oh,
and even if we're not reading them as a group, we've gone off individually and
Judy, that is so gives me a chill. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yes, so we say to everybody, keep reading, stick with your group. Yeah. Some move away, some come back in, but stick with it. It's just really a valuable part of our lives.
Oh, thank you, Judy. So, thank you, you're a doll. Thank you
very
much.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you also. We're going to do our author interview now with Mark Taylor, who has this book called Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. Thank you, Pat Towers, as always. Roxanne Cody and Lee Jacobus are here. You're welcome to stay and join the conversation. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about everything being speeded up, how it got here, and what it costs us. Is it good? It's bad? It's everything. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for being a part of our show. I've been having the best time on this particular edition. We're going to turn now to an author conversation, and it is a very interesting and smart book. But just want to let you know, though, that we have set up, we're calling it the hottest scene in Connecticut. It really is. It's our Food Schmooze Martini Competition, where all the statewide bartenders shake up innovative martinis, and you vote for the Food Schmooze Martini Champion. We have a designated driver discount, great top chef noshes, the DJ sizzles. It sells out every time. It is Thursday, June 25th at 6 p.m., at Simsbury's Riverview, thanks to Power Station Events, $60 tickets. You can order them now at ctmartini.org, and you will see a button on the right-hand side of the page to order tickets, ctmartini.org. We applied to the Guinness Book of World Records, by the way, to for this very martini event that we're talking about. So this will be interesting. Okay, we have now Mark Taylor. He's written Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. It is published by Yale University Press. They do such a great job in their selections. So here we go. This was very, very smart, I thought, as I read this book. he says, Mark, as we welcome him, call waiting, endless conference calls, mandatory Skype meetings, no matter where you are or what time it is, urgent weekend business trips to deal with what could have waited until Monday, just in time, everything, sleeping with an iPhone beside the bed, checking email all night, receiving email while in a cab heading to dinner with a friend and returning to the office, longer and longer workday weeks, week after week, 70, 80, 90 hours without a break, in real time, everything speeds up until time itself seems to disappear, and fast is never fast enough. Everything has to be done now, instantly, to pause, to delay, to stop, to miss an opportunity, and to give a competitor the edge. Speed has become the measure of success. Faster chips, faster computers, faster networks, faster connectivity, faster news, faster communications, faster transactions, faster delivery, faster product cycles, faster brains, faster kids, faster lives. According to the gospel of speed, the quick inherit the earth. Yep, that about sums it up. That sounds like life right now. Mark Taylor, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
So let me say, I forgot to say that you are professor and chair, Department of Religion at Columbia University. You're a cultural critic and a leading philosopher, as I know. Okay, Mark, this has been talked about, you know, to some degree, what we're losing. What did you set out to do, your different take on this?
Well, one thing I tried to do was to show how this condition has emerged and to show the different aspects of our lives that that it influences. The section you read suggests some of that. But it's not just faster computers, but it pervades all of our lives. It's fast food, it's fast networks, it's fast fashion. And to try to really understand how all of this interconnects and how it has emerged, because all of this really begins by going during the Industrial Revolution. And I trace it back, my own reflection on this, to two things. One, conversations with my father I used to have, who was raised on a Pennsylvania farm in the early 20th century, and his life was not that different from what it had been 200 years ago. And the last years of his life, we would often discuss whether he would have seen more he was born in 1907, whether he would have seen more changes than I would have. And he was always convinced that, you know, from the Wright brothers to Man on the Moon, he used to say that I would never see changes like he had. But, of course, I have seen changes, and I think now they're even greater than during his life.
Can you explain this? Because this is interesting to me, where you talk about how I always catch myself saying to people, well, it's just like we were in a time just like the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And everybody was so caught, and suddenly you're swept up in this dramatic change.
Right.
And I would think of that as a separate thing all by itself. And your contention in the book is that what we are doing right now is still part of that Industrial Revolution.
Yes, I think it's an extension of it. First of all, it's important to remember that many of the technologies that we see as so important today, the digital and electronic technologies, had their origin in the 19th century. You had telephone and telegraph, which developed in tandem with the railroads global system, because the lines were laid along the railroad lines. The first transatlantic cable, people forget, was completed in 1859. And much of the infrastructure that we now have for the physical infrastructure of the Internet follows pathways that were set down in the 19th century for telephone and telegraph cables. But in addition to that, as soon as one moved into industrial production, there came to be a premium put on speed and efficiency. And famously, Frederick Winslow Taylor about 1911 took his stopwatch quite literally into factories to time people to figure out the best way to make them most productive. If anybody's seen Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, it's sort of embodied there.
Mm-hmm.
So this obsession with speed is tied to a particular economic structure. That's the point that needs to be seen.
Yeah, Mark, I love this part where you were saying For instance, industrialization comes and we suddenly have to deal with train travel.
Correct.
And you write that this bodily acceleration had this enormous psychological effect that some people found completely disorienting, other people found it exhilarating.
Right.
But it was this mechanization of movement
created
what Anne Friedberg, you're quoting, describes as the mobile gaze.
Correct.
Which transforms one's surroundings and alters both the content and, more important, the structure of perception. So here's how it went. Does this sound like now? I'm quoting you. During the early years, there were numerous accounts of the experience of railway travel by ordinary people, distinguished writers, even physicians, in which certain themes recur. The most common complaint is the sense of disorientation brought about by the experience of this unprecedented speed. And so people would say to each other, the landscape is incessantly rushing by faster than we can apprehend it. You say that when you researched, people said they suffered from overstimulation.
Right.
It created a sense of psychological exhaustion and physical distress.
Right.
And physicians began to make claims about that speed was causing things like neuralgia, tooth decay, even premature baldness.
I mean, it sounds just like hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder today.
Yeah.
And was treated as such. One important thing to realize that the first thing that speed produces is a sense of slowness. That is to say, the horse wasn't slow until you had the car, right? And your new computer, your old computer isn't slow till you get your new computer. So it's the constant acceleration of all the technologies and of all parts of life. But I think the important question to ask is what is driving this obsession with speed?
Yes.
And the way I've come to understand that, I mean, over the years, I've done a lot of work in both in my writing and my teaching with new technologies. When the Internet emerged and the World Wide Web and everything, there was this grandiose sense that these new technologies, as always the way it is, were going to liberate us. And in 1971, President Nixon actually appointed a commission to explore how we would deal with the problem when in 20 or 25 years people would only be working 20 hours a week,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to have so much leisure time. There are paradoxes with the way in which these technologies have developed. These technologies that were supposed to save us time now take all of our time. We're wedded to them. The iPhone has become the ball and chain. You're never unplugged. You're working 24/7, 365. These technologies that were supposed to connect us are dividing us. It has not created the global village Marshall McLuhan anticipated, but rather creates these bubbles in which each individual is plugged into with his earbuds, with his own playlist and his own newspaper. So that there are these paradoxes. The more connected we become, the more divided we become.
So together alone, as you say in the book.
Together alone, exactly.
Why was speed the golden child? As we can see with the Internet, yes, of course, this makes things easier. You get more done. Back then, industrialization. But why does everyone resort to speed? It's not enough to get more.
Right.
We must keep going as fast as we can. Why that?
Because time's money. It's the economic system that we've created. We have created an economic system that is dependent upon what I believe is to be unsustainable economic growth. If you have a system in which economic well-being is measured by growth, and that's recent, it's a product of really the Cold War, we could talk about that,
mm-hmm.
but if economic well-being is measured by growth, there are only three ways markets can expand. Spatially, you open a new branch in another town or another country. Differentially, you create more different products. The average American supermarket today has 48,000 different products. Or temporally, you accelerate the product cycle. When Obama was elected, the iPhone hadn't even been introduced. So the obsession with speed and the constant claims about creative disruption and innovation is simply a way of expanding the market through planned obsolescence. if people aren't borrowing and spending money they don't have for stuff they don't need in this constant turnover, the economy falters. So speed is intimately tied to a certain form of capitalism, really. And as you go from a consumer capitalism to this new form of capitalism that we have, which is financial capitalism, speed becomes even more of an item.
Yes.
Because in previous forms of capitalism, you make money by selling your labor or stuff. In this form of capitalism, big money is made by trading signs, by trading financial assets that are backed by nothing other than other signs. And virtual assets, you know, mortgage bond, all the derivatives and all that stuff, that scales at a rate much faster than real assets.
Yeah, so that explains the divide, the rich get richer
exactly.
And the poor get poorer.
But there's the point that people don't realize. The wealth gap is a speed gap. When I was in college, the people who were going to make money were going to be doctors. Not anymore, because being a doctor doesn't scale in the same way that high-speed, high-volume networks scale in billions and billions of dollars in nanoseconds. So the problem is structural.
Yeah. This is Mark Taylor. He's author of Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. You quote, I think it was Bertrand Russell, who wrote this essay in praise of idleness. And
right.
If I can say what you wrote here when you quote him, he said, he explained, although my conscience has controlled my actions, my opinions have undergone a revolution. I think that there is far too much work done in the world, that immense harm is caused by the belief that work is virtuous. And what needs to be preached in modern industrial countries is quite different from what always has been preached.
Right.
He insists that only a foolish asceticism, usually vicarious, makes us continue to insist on work in excessive quantities now that the need no longer exists. So this is this divide between time and money.
Right.
It almost reads like a mortal sin to say something like that in this age that we're in.
You're absolutely right. And that underscores another important point, because another point that needs to be made here is that there has been a change in the social status of leisure. In previous eras and in different societies, social status is measured by how little you work. In our society, social status is measured by how much you work. If you're not wired 24/7, 365, you're not very important. And that's a profound change, it seems. We've heard the reports. Americans don't take all their vacation. Why? In large part, there are many reasons, but part of it is they're afraid they'll lose their jobs if somebody else will take it. But it's also it's a quasi-Protestantism, right, in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. You make that point.
Right, the virtue of work. And that's at the heart of our political debate, because it's complicated, but this kind of hostility towards so-called leisure is part of what is at the heart of the conservative critique of the social welfare system.
Mark, unfortunately, I could talk to you for this whole hour, but unfortunately we have about a minute left. So very quickly, why is this not the cycle of change that we always go through as human beings in a social culture?
Well, I think the notion of cycle suggests that this is continually renewable. Part of what needs to be seen is that the price of speed of this kind of economic system based upon speed makes demands, not only psychological, social, and economic demands, but it makes demands on the environment that cannot be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
That will be, I think, what will run.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. Great book, Speed Limits, Mark C. Taylor. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find all the things we talk about on our website, either at foodschmooze.org or The Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
I said, "Bless me to heaven."